I don't always like to speak because I don't know what's going to come out of my mouth. Sometimes I get up here and I like black out, it seems like. And I don't know if this is right or if I'm just giving God the beef, but whatever thought comes to my mind, I usually just kick it. And I think that's turning it over. I don't know if that's a fact or not, but that's usually what I do, because if I start censoring it, you know, I don't know. I just don't do that. I've been thinking recently about I could belong to Lifestyle Anonymous if they had it. But I was thinking about that addict thing. I think God wired me to be an addict, and he should have put a sign on me: don't give this guy any mind-altering chemicals, because he will be dangerous, sign God. And I got a hold of that mind-altering chemicals, and I was an addict. You know, I was an activated addict now that I put a chemical in me. Whatever I did like a pig. I started off, I thought I had enough when I threw up. And throwing up really means that your body's rejecting the poison, because nicotine's poison, liquor, drugs, all that's poison. So initially your body rejects it. Then you build a tolerance, and you build a tolerance, and if a snake bites you, it dies after a while. So we do recover. I feel like I've experienced a lot of healing. I'm 59. I'm still living. Most people I've associated with or come by in the last years, they're dead. He's dead. She's dead. I did 14 years in prison by the time I was 31, so I was exposed to thousands of addicts, because probably 90-some percent in prison are addicts, drugs and alcohol, and then there's some gambling, some par, maybe some sex, but probably 90-some percent. And I've seen very few of them come in the fellowship. I've been in the fellowship since 1978. I was at the first meeting, and they held it at a Gateway. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that, but I like to cause controversy sometimes. Not too much, but thank God for NA Rangers. They don't let me get too crazy, or I'd have us all in jail. I wanted to sell watches in the back. I wanted a kissing booth, a yard of tongue for a dollar. Raise the money. I wanted to have that Simpsons t-shirt with meetings on the back and say, hey, dude, where's the meetings? That's how I thought. I thought, what is the objective and how can we accomplish it? And I wasn't worried about traditions. And since I was around at the beginning, I didn't have to. But I nominated a guy after me. I was the first area chair of PASNA. But I nominated a guy after me that was pretty well educated. And I figured he could do something with them Robert's Rules and them 12 tradition. My idea was fuck him and the horse Robert come in on. I didn't care nothing about him and didn't want to know nothing about him. I passed out meeting lists in the Hill District. I just walked on foot by myself and handed them to people. We only had 4 meetings. I went in bars, put them in the bathroom, taped them up in the nuisance bars. I didn't care. The objective was to get the word out. A woman named Dot Talley nominated me to be the first area chair. I said, thank you. I wanted the job. Never even heard of area service. So we started out with 4 meetings. And so I seen the growth in this fellowship from 1978 to now. And back then there was only 200 meetings worldwide. And now I don't know what there is, 20 or 30,000. I helped start NA. I felt for others, not me. I didn't feel the need for me, because I had a year in the other fellowship, and I had a burning bush initially, and through the burning bush, the obsession to use was lifted, so I really didn't feel like I needed any fellowship. I was a person that was a step 1 and step 12 from the jump, in my mind. So, and I figured my friends and my homies and my walkies, Narcotics Anonymous, that name alone would appeal to them more than the other fellowship. And so I wanted to help get this fellowship together for others, not me, believe me. And I didn't know how to be a chair because I didn't have no reference. So I thought I was the godfather. The GSRs was my lieutenants. And the business was to get NA out there, you know. But it worked through him. I give all credit through my higher power. I did a small part, and I think we all play a part. And if anybody plays too big of a part, it's not good for that person or the fellowship, I believe. And the part I played, I believe it was definitely through my higher power. I seen evidence of my higher power, especially when I went down the road. I would look back and see definite what I would interpret it as evidence of a higher power. I just don't think NA would have come together, and it wouldn't work without a higher power. And from my personal experience, I've did a lot of searching. I have never seen anything as successful as Narcotics Anonymous. You know, to me, it's phenomenal. There's people, if they see some dew on a window, millions of people will go there to see that dew if it looks like some type of higher power, right? This must be the best-kept secret. I mean, they should be peeping in the windows of that now. Because everybody in here is a miracle, I think. I mean, it's strong. To be out here and not copping, it just blows my mind. I get goosebumps. I know how to cop, where to cop, got money, ain't on parole, ain't on probation, and I'm out here not copping. I never was in the street and didn't try to cop or cop. I was going to cop that day or go to prison, you know. I tried to cop in prison. I left a joint once after smoking a joint. I mean, I was fired up. So we do recovery, and I think the healing is, I have, through the healing and the fact that I'm still out here, I've been out of prison 28 years, and I got everything in my story. I have asked my higher power, please, no more experiences. I got enough. And, but I mean, I got them all, but I don't blame them experiences for me being an addict. I do think some of those experiences did a number on me. I can say both parents were alcoholic. My father left when I was a year old. My mother had a lot of men in common law and shack ups, and they were violent men. And my mother would watch men beat me and abuse me, and she wouldn't say nothing. I was never held or hugged or loved by my mother. And that carried over. I was choking women. Then I would choke them some more because they was upset I just choked them. And I went from choking women to chewing their food in my process. You know, I don't know where it's gonna, if it's going to ever go any farther than that. But there's been progress, and I haven't touched a woman since 1968. So that's a healing, and it probably come from my mother, the hate I had for her. I've been in a lot of therapy. I've been in 300 groups as a patient. I was in a rehab 724 for 2 years. They hired me as a therapist in the mid-70s. I was around 25. I didn't even know what the word meant. I still don't. But I had so much patient experience as being a patient and a client, they hired me. And I've been a meth counselor, Salvation Army counselor. I've had, you know, a lot of experience and exposure to that. So I have this type of parents. I was born in what they call Skid Row. Now it would be the hood. The ghetto, now it's the hood, you know. But it was, you know, Skid Row, and I loved it. It was very stimulating for me. I was like blind. I mean, it was like people didn't must have not have saw me, because in my household, I could go out anytime, come and go. I could come and go with school, and I was more go than coming. And it was like, you know, I got away with it somehow. I got out there. My first thing was hustling. That would be making money up. So I start becoming a juvenile delinquent at 6 or 7. After the first grade, that's when I start flipping. It didn't take long for me. I did experience love from the first grade nun and from my grandmother, which I'm grateful for that. Love is very strong. I didn't have a lot, but what I had was strong enough for me to appreciate it. And it might have made the difference, me being a psychopath, because I was only a few fries short of being a psychopath. They ran a 3-hour group on me to see if there was any saving grace for me. And I didn't know what they want. I wanted into rehab. I'm in the penitentiary. I got 3.5 years in. This rehab's co-ed, good food. And I'm in the street, and I didn't know what they wanted. I kept saying, yeah, I went in. I need help. And they ran a group on me to see if there was any saving grace. And I ain't budging. I got my legs crossed, AC Deuce. I'm as cool as can be. And they had me visualize my son, 2 years old. And you know how you get some Kodak memories in your head that they just stick here? Well, he come and visit me in the penitentiary, and he was 2 years old. And I could say, and he had a bow tie on and a vest and a pair of shorts on. And they had me visualizing him saying, bye, Daddy, after the end of the visit. And I just broke and start crying. So that was that's what got me into rehab, and that's what they felt that there was hope for me. Not much, but there was some. I used to feel guilty if I didn't do wrong. Up was down, left was right, right was left. If you call us a snake or a dog, you were giving us a compliment. I mean, to flip out of that culture. So I was in the street at 6, 7, and I was into hustling, shining shoes, selling papers. Then I got into sneak thieving and shoplifting and stopped working. That was my work, and I would sneak thief and shoplift. I had a detective and I had a judge say at 11, 12 years old that I would spend the rest of my life in prison. So I got into stealing. So I'm into stuff before the chemical. And I said to myself recently, I could have ended up in a lot worse place than Narcotics Anonymous. And with the lifestyle I was in, I had to go somewhere. I had to go somewhere. There had to be consequences for that. So I'm in that thing, and I go to prison at 11 for 5 burglaries, and I was at Thornhill twice, Morganza twice, Forestry, Camp Hill, Greaterford, Western, Huntington, Lancaster County Jail, and the Allegheny County Jail. And I had all them years, and by 31, and it's funny, I'm at where they have the first meeting, Double Bubble, and the guy in the basic text that Bob, his story's the first one in the basic text. I get busted in Lancaster. I'm trying to cash a hot check from Chicago with black ID. You know, I know 99 out of 100 I'm going to get busted. But I was caught in the grips. I just couldn't stop. I couldn't deviate. I just had to go up to the teller. I couldn't stop myself. And ironic, 2 years later, I would be in this rehab, and this guy, Bob, would bring the meeting in. See, I don't think that was coincidence. The two years later, I'm at this rehab when they have the first NA meeting. And that through him, I was inspired to want to see NA in Pittsburgh. So we started NA in Pittsburgh with 4 meetings. Before we even had a area service, we were at a convention. It was called East Coast Convention at that time. And this guy, Frankie, says, Tim, we should have this convention in Pittsburgh. So I went to this other guy, Bob. I said, if we get it, will you take it? He said, no. So me and Frank goes in the back room, and we're figuring, you know, make a bid on this convention. And we said, Pittsburgh would like to have it. They says, okay, you got it. So we go back. We don't even have an area service yet. And here we're bringing back a convention for our area. I mean, it was pretty, I'd pick people's GSRs, everything, and wouldn't even be a home group member. I mean, we did a lot of stuff like that then. I guess it was good just to get us rolling, then we needed stuff down the road. But I don't think that was a coincidence. I went in with a leather collar up and a hat, and the guy in front of me had a 3-piece suit with a vest and a white cape, a white hat, and a white cane. And we think we're tipping. And we're thinking we're low profile, and we'd have stuck out in Harlem. I mean, we was saying, look at us. We're in here to take your shit. We're here. So the healing, we do recovery. A guy said to me, he said he's recovering from himself. And I don't know if you hear some things that really fit for you, and that fit for me. I only heard that probably about a year ago. And that made sense. I'm recovering from what I did do in life, what I didn't do in life. I'm becoming from a negative person to a positive person. The transitions in recovery through going to meetings and relationships, interaction and steps and working with others. I'm getting needs met that I don't even know. But I can say that they're all getting met. You know, all my needs are getting met, and I'm content. And I'm probably getting a mother off somebody, a father off somebody, a brother, a sister, so forth and so forth and so forth. The street was my home, and the people out there was my family. And I had a real strong bond with that, real strong. I mean, more so than anything, you know. So that was hard. I guess at the end of the road for me, after spending all that time in treatment, they didn't give me closure. Plus, there was a lot of drink while you was in the program, as long as you didn't do opiates. And I didn't get closure there, and after being in all them groups, and I cooperated. I got addicted to the place. I liked it. I thought it was a trip. I thought it was some new experience. I liked stuff like that. And so I went back to the penitentiary, and if I felt fear now, I would show it. My lip would twitch. My eye would twitch. I'd be looking like Barney Fife, you know. Walking in the penitentiary yard is not healthy, looking like Barney Fife. So part of me would come down and see Barney, and then I'd get paranoid because I know what kind of signals I'm kicking out here. You know, I'm kicking out, I want to be a victim, I'm vulnerable. So I almost had a breakdown. I might have had a breakdown, and I asked to go to self-lockup because my nervous system didn't say, Tim, do you want this breakdown or not? It didn't ask me. It just came. And but that was part of my bottom, and I resented my higher power for that because there was times that I wanted them walls up. I wanted that up because you got to have something up to be out there in that thing. And I resented him for a while on that where he did all that. I thought he helped, you know, make me hit a bottom. And so I was in solitary confinement, and I'm sleeping 23 hours a day out of 24. People's throwing they're setting their cell on fire and hanging up and people screaming and hollering. They said I went through some post-trauma, like Vietnam or something, I guess. Just living in that environment, stepping over people that just got killed. And I was down at Western. It was wide open. I mean, you had homos. You had people getting high. You had jazz on the stage. And the Temptations come in, and sometimes we would forget where we were, that we were in the penitentiary. I mean, just to live in that kind of life, day in and day out, I mean, it has to do damage to you. When I come in the rooms, this was like, I mean, being in the street, not using, and getting a job, that was like punishment for, he was punishing me now because I was working legit, and, it didn't make sense to me. I didn't get gratification getting a check at the end of the week. I wanted to get paid right now. but that stuff didn't. Then I was, I have a impulsive compulsive disorder. I would impulsively get married, impulsively leave, impulsively make babies, impulsively leave the babies, impulsively get a job, and impulsively quit. I had over 100 cribs, 100 jobs, and you know what I mean? I just was so obsessive and compulsive. I was, when I would kick in the street, it wasn't kicking. I wanted 3 or 4 days off the opiates, and I'd be doing something else. So I'm taking these Tylenols for 3 days, and I go to get a pack of cigarettes, and I look down, there's a space gun. I take it out, I buy it, I take it out of the bag, I put it in my pocket, I stumble across the street to the drugstore, and I tell them it's a stick-up. I mean, an impulse. That carries 10 to 20 years. I'm not doing those dangerous of impulses today, but, man, I was really impulsive. I mean, I'm going to do what I want if it kills me. I'm going to fly now, and I'm going to pay later. I'm going to do it today for tomorrow. I may be jail or dead. I left a joint with 27 and a half years back up smoking a joint. You know what I mean? And that was, you know, really crazy. Then they give me 6 to 12 months for the check. I says, I got 27 and a half years back up. What are you giving me 6 to 12 months for? You trying to, you know what I mean? I could have got really jammed up on that stuff. And so I ended up going back to another treatment center, and I really wanted help, but I saw the place was phony. When I would hear the word program, I thought this is something you go to get out of prison or not to go to prison. Program automatically meant that to me, any and all programs. At that time, I think I was 30s or something, and I never heard of anybody but one person turning it around, and that didn't impress me. So I'm in this rehab, and I run away from it, and I turn myself back in, and my parole officer's, oh, no, oh, yeah. So he says, be cool, I'll get you in this 28. He said, I'll be cool, I'll get you in this 28-day rehab. Co-ed, good food, you know, my type of place. And he says, I want you to live with your mother on the Hill District. And my mother's living in a 24-7. They sell white port, 50 cent a glass. And back then they had nickel bags, a reefer, $5 bags, $2.50 bags. Percodan was 10 cent. I mean, the Dilaudids were two. I mean, I don't want to get your mouth watered. Then there was guys out there before me. Oh, we were getting dope for 2 cent. You know, there's, you know, always hear that. So I'm living in the Hill District, and it's a bad spot when they sell white port. Don't shake it over here. I got a lot of hoe in me, boy. That's okay. I don't play worms, insects, none of that. We're in that, I also have memory lapse. I'm having one now. I have legit memory lapses, and, it's good. I don't remember what I worry about now, huh? Oh yeah, I went to live with my mother, and, my man's, listen, you get an A for, okay. He probably heard me before. He could tell it for me. But I don't know if you've been in one of these joints, white port, 50 cent a glass, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And people go in there just to warm up, no ice cubes. And it was a bad spot. The police didn't want to come in there when they heard there was a homicide or something. So one day, I'm waiting to go to this 28-day rehab, and I'm living there. I'm smoking a joint. I'm smoking, drinking wine. And I decide to go rob a house that day. So I get on a bus, no money, and to a nice neighborhood, and I get off, and I try to rob his house. It's Good Friday. That's the last time I've been arrested. So I think that's good, significant for me. At least I remember. So I'm trying to rob his house, and I could have violated 27 and a half plus 10 to 20 now for a burglary. I could have, 10 to 20 would have been a plea bargain and doing me a favor. So my PO whispers in the magistrate's ear. The magistrate gives me 10 days. I never had a 10-day sentence in my life. So they send me, this time my PO sent me to the county jail to wait to an opening for this rehab. So since I only have a 10-day sentence, they make me a trustee. Now I'm making dope moves. So I can't cooperate. I can't take credit for all this. Then I go to this 28-day rehab. And this broad tells me she's horny. I never had a broad in my life tell me she's horny. I've been married 3 times. And if I get busted with her, I violate 27 and a half years. So I was a nervous wreck. It was a quickie, quickie, quickie. I mean, and right away without thinking, I said, meet me in my room. And my roommate comes in and busts me, but he don't snitch on me to the last day. So I go to this halfway house, and this other girl writes me and says she loves me. I mean, I never got so much rhythm in my life. You know how you get stuff when you shouldn't get stuff, or you get stuff that ain't good for you? And I was getting it left and right then. So make it worse, I come up the following week on family day to visit this other one, and I know they didn't want me there after my escapades with another one. Now I'm meeting another one. She rents a van with a mattress in the parking lot. I said, oh, God. And so it was crazy. I got married in recovery. I had kids in recovery. I had businesses. This was a lot of anxiety for me. It was a lot of stress. And I must have had my concept of what you're supposed to do now when you don't use, what you're supposed to do now when you're a square. And I must have been thinking Ozzie and Harriet or Leave It to Beaver or the Cosbys. You know what I mean? I didn't have nothing. So I guess I thought, well, you have wives, kids, homes, 2 dogs, 2 cats. And I was a nervous wreck. I got all that shit. And it wasn't me, but I got it anyway. My one son's a minister now, and he was born in recovery. My first son was born to heroin. He was born, and they had a detox. And he's 40 years old now. But the 2 kids I had in recovery, one's a minister and the other one's wanna be a hoodie. He carries a gun. He married this girl 10 years older that's a chronic alcoholic. They live in the projects. And he tells me he wants to be a jitney. He's white too. I mean, so I try to look at them like no facial reactions, like, what the fuck are you? I mean, we had $15 an hour jobs for this kid. We had all kind of things, anything. And he wants to be a jitney. It's like that Steve Martin movie, How the Jerk or something. And so I have that. I mean, I was the best father I could be. I was a good husband. I got better each time. I got married twice in recovery. The last one lasted 8.5 years. And she didn't want to deal with some mental health issues or counseling. She said God said not to go. So she didn't go there. She didn't try to keep the marriage going. But it lasted 8.5 years, and I felt good about it because I got better at it. I told you, I went from choking to chewing her food. I loved the love. I mean, I laid this broad out. I would shop, cook, clean. I mean, I would do it all and got a lot of pleasure from it. I don't know where that come from, but... I don't know where that come from, but I had it going on strong. What time's this in? 10:15? 10:30? I'm going to close because I don't have a clue what time it is, what day it is. Where the fuck am I at? I have did that a lot. Where the fuck am I at? What day is this? Because I got into traveling, too, throughout the United States and Canada. But I still like to travel. This is funny, and I'm going to quit. I camped out once, and it rained at a New York convention, and that was enough for me in life. I rode a horse once here to that chair, and that was enough for me. Riding a horse, that was my horse experience for life. And he parked. I said, give him an hour off for a break. And so what I'm trying to do now is learn how to be homeless. And it's hard even telling people that. But I'm trying to learn how to be homeless so I can travel more and won't have to pay cost for living out in the street and in alleys. And I'm thinking there's bears in the woods and in the alleys, you got wackos. So I slept out last night on my sleeping bag, and I really felt good about myself, really proud. You know, I made it, and no bears grabbed me or nothing. And so that was good. That was progress because I faced the fear. I want to thank everybody, and it was a pleasure to share. And I enjoy our recovery. This one woman was my sponsor for a minute. I had two women, but I wanted to bang them both, so I had to let them go. I'm talking about blind, 8 to 80 blind, crippled, and crazy. And the one that had 38 years, she was blind. It didn't mean nothing to me. I got addicted once to having orgasms in recovery. 6 months, I couldn't go to sleep if I didn't have one. The girl says, I'm watching Johnny Carson. I said, go ahead. You can keep watching Johnny. Don't worry. So this woman, she died with 38 years clean. She used to say, pray and get laid. Enjoy your recovery. Take care.
I'm Leanne, I'm an addict, and I'd like to introduce our next speaker. He is Mark from Friday Night Live group of NA in the Lamana area. I guess I hope I said that.
Well, that's a tough act to follow. I knew I should have went first. My name's Mark, and I'm an addict. I like to start off by saying, like, I used to be one of those guys. I was doing some work on my father's house last summer, and we were tearing down a section of the house and putting it back up. And in doing so, I stumbled across this box that there was some old paperwork in there from when I was a kid, and I used to get in trouble, and some paperwork that from the judge saying that, you know, I was one of those guys that had to go to one meeting a week. You know, because that was going to get me right. And so, you know, I did that because of a court order. And if you'd asked me back then what recovery was, you know, I would have told you that recovery was not using. And that's really what I thought it was. And as I as I travel in this journey, I've the veil's been lifted to some extent, and I recognize that it's so much more. And with that thought in mind, I like to say that, you know, I've always had like certain memories of when I was a kid, you know, just things that happened. We all have that, like just things that happened to us when we were a kid. And, you know, two things, come to mind that is relevant to my journey. And when I was 5 years old, I stole this peppermint patty candy bar from this restaurant right up the street from my parents' place. And in doing so, like I crossed the line, you know, I figured out how to get what I wanted, in other ways besides what I would usually have to do, like take the trash out, wait for the allowance, or go cut some grass, or whatever, you know. And you know, I like to talk about how that progresses and what that involves. And you know, it starts with that peppermint candy bar, but eventually, like, you know, I'm stealing toys, and then I'm dipping in mom's pocketbook trying to get money for pinball or pizza, or doing whatever we do, and turning it up a notch. I start boosting, stealing stuff from one place, selling it to another, and stealing stuff out of cars and whatever. But there's a progression there. There's a progression. Once I cross that line and I learned that, I stuck that tool in my belt and I went with it. And another thing I like to talk about is when I was 7 years old, I was just being a kid, and I was building this fort with my best friend, and we were stacking these rocks up in this field, making this wall. And in doing that, I had disturbed this bee's nest, and these bees started swarming all over me, right, biting me, stinging me. And so, you know, I start running home, and they're all over me, staying with me, and I'm crying because I'm a little boy, you know. And I get like a block away from my parents' place, and I see that there's some people sitting on the porch that I don't even know, okay? I don't even know these people, but they can see me crying, okay? And so I duck behind this telephone pole, right? And actually go around the corner, go around the long way, so that these people won't see me cry. And you know, this is just a memory. It was just a memory, but what it tells me, it reveals something to me about where I was at that age of my life. I mean, at 7 years old, I had bought into the notion that it was inappropriate for me to display certain emotions in front of people, okay? And that, you know, I bought into this ideology of what a man was supposed to be at 7 years old, and that's crazy. But, you know, I like to talk about how that progresses, or how that progressed for me. And, you know, In doing that project at my father's house, there was another thing that I found in that box, and it was this cup from like grade school. You know, in the art class, we used to take clay and we would make cups or bowls or whatever, and we would stencil stuff on it and fire it and take it home and paint it or whatever. And this cup, it must have been from like third or fourth grade, I don't know. But like it said on the side, it said, "Mark, coolest of cools," okay? And see, what that tells me is that, I mean, it sounds corny, but like what it tells me is that at that young age, like it was important for me to be that guy. You know, I wanted to be cool. I wanted to be the bad boy or whatever. And there's a lot of stuff that goes along with that. I aligned myself with a certain type of people, you know, and we did certain types of things. And in doing that, we had certain boundaries that we created between us and them, so to speak. Like for me, like authority figures in general became, the enemy, you know. People who stood in the way of me doing just whatever I wanted to do became the enemy. It was us and them. Teachers, principals, police officers, ultimately probation officers, parents, you know, oftentimes just people who were older in general. And, you know, what that brought with it was, you know, at the age of 13, I mean, just constantly bucking the system, doing my thing. You know, what happened is, by the age of 13, you know, this boy was no longer his parents' child. You know, I had alienated myself and had become an island of sorts. And this is all really relevant. I say all this to say that I didn't get high until I was that age. You know what I'm saying? Like, I never even touched a drink or a drug until that point. And then, and so there was a lot of things going on before I ever went into that stuff. And that's relevant to my journey. Because when we talk about we do recover, you know, for me, you know, I recognize today that it's about so much more than just the drink or the drug. And you know, once I crossed that line, of course, you know, then I was off the hook. You know, I became more desensitized to what I was doing to other people. I cared less and less about others and was more focused on me just doing me, you know, focused on doing whatever it took to get whatever I wanted. And so we turned it up a notch. And, you know, the literature tells us that we have three inevitabilities, you know, when we go on this path, jails, institutions, and death. And like my man that spoke before me, you know, for me, it ended up being like institutions and jails ultimately. And later in the age of 13, I was sent to a group home, and I was in Glen Mills and Abraxas and the detention centers and all of this as a kid. And you know, I remember being in this one group home. And all day, you know, I was a killer. All day I was a tough guy trying to fit in with the rest of these kids. And, I remember laying in my bunk bed at night. You know, this is a kid that did everything he could to stay away from home. You know, was sneaking out the window at night, or just trying to stay away from home for days on end, not being responsible, not going to school or whatever. But, you know, found myself laying in my bunk at night crying like a little boy should, like missing home, you know, and that was real to me. And every time I would come home from one of these places, like, I would remember that. I would remember the pain of being away. And for a minute, it would be on the strength of that pain that I would stay clean. I would not get high. Okay? And, one thing I recognize is that, each and every time I would not be willing to divorce myself from the people, places, and things, though. You know, I would not get high for a minute, but I would still go around the same people, do the same things, go to the same places. And ultimately, in every single case, what happened was that I would cross that line and just do that one. And once I would do that one, it was like, well, I fucked it up. I might as well go all the way. And every single time, that's how it happened for me. And I recognized that I was taught to, like, look at that past and try to discover themes that existed in any attempts at getting clean before. But at any rate, for me, you know, so I got into this cycle. I got into this cycle where, you know, it was just a whole bunch of that stuff. And it didn't change when I became an adult. And much like my man that spoke before me, I went to prison. And, you know, it's crazy. You know, I ended up doing, when I was 18, I did 2 years, 8 months at Camp Hill. I came home, and, you know, that was a pretty big piece for me. And so I stayed clean and did not, again, divorce myself from those people, places, and things and cross that line eventually. And, got involved with some of the people I'd met on the inside. You know, met some new kind of hustlers, some folks that were in the game, who were pumping product and whatever, and, you know, discovered a whole new flavor of hustling. You know, a whole new levels of power over people, money, and levels of get high, and it really appealed to me. It's once you've had a taste of that, it's difficult to step back away from that. And so I got involved with that, and not soon after that, you know, I ended up in a federal prison in New Jersey, and I did some state time in New York and Pennsylvania, and I did 10 years, 2 months, and 16 days. And, you know, I was sitting in Rockview for 4 years, which is a little penitentiary not far outside of State College. And for 4 years, I had Girlie bringing me packages, and supplementing that with whatever hustling cigarettes and buying shit off the block or whatever, but still getting high every day, okay? And what happened for me is I got knocked off in Rockview with some weed and ended up going to the box and for 5 months and lost my contact visits for a year. And they were scrutinizing my urine, like, to the extent that there was just no way of getting away with it anymore. And if I had one more incident of anything, then I would lose my contact visits forever. And I had a lot of time in front of me at that point, and I couldn't stand to go there. So reluctantly, I put the drugs down. And we talk about having a moment of clarity. And for me, that happens somewhere in there. And I realized that this was a common denominator in my failure, and that if I was going to salvage anything of what was left of my life, then I needed to take a look at that and maybe become willing to stay clean. And so I did. And I put some time in, and was shuffled around from a federal prison to upstate New York. And when I got close to coming home, I went to a place called Mount McGregor, and there was a condition for me to make my parole date, and that was that I go to this program, within the penitentiary. And if anybody has any familiarity with that sort of thing, nobody wants to go to a program inside the penitentiary, because it's like a jail within a jail, rules within the jail, and you try to avoid it. And so I didn't want to go, but I wanted to get out. I wanted to come home. And so again, reluctantly, I tried it. And inside there was a Puerto Rican brother, named Tony Gonzalez. He won't mind me saying his name, who sold me on the notion of recovery being useful in, or program, like you said, being useful in me salvaging something of what was left of my life. And as opposed to doing a lot of the comparing stuff that I used to do, like, oh, you're that, I'm this, you don't have nothing for me, or I always know better. I mean, just always being closed-minded. I started listening and finding myself in the people that were around me, even inside the walls of this penitentiary, in this program, finding myself in these other people and discovering that there were things that I needed to take a look at. And one of those things that was revealed to me in a relapse prevention class was that theme of not divorcing myself from people, places, and things when I came home every single time in the past. And so I knew that my life was on the line. I knew that, you know, after doing 10 years, that, you know, they don't typically give you less time. They usually, you know, and so, they, you know, I knew definitively for myself that my life was really on the line. And so I took this very seriously. And I took the suggestion that, you know, when I came home, Tony G said, you know, get a sponsor, go to a meeting, get a sponsor, do a 90 and 90. Okay. And so, when I came home, I went to a meeting the next day, and hooked up and reached out to people. Actually, the theme of this meeting was a gratitude meeting, okay? And folks were going around the room talking about gratitude. Oh, it's a beautiful day. Oh, you know, I had some car problems and sorted them out, and that's great. And, you know, I'm grateful that, you know, such and such and whatever, whatever. And I was walking, they were coming around, coming to me. And, you know, I was overwhelmed. I was moved, like this gentleman was talking, on the strength of having been where I had been. Like, I was grateful to touch a tree. You know, I was thinking about the things that I hadn't been able to do. I was grateful to, like, be able to pet a dog. You know, because the only dogs we ever saw were drug dogs, and, you know, you weren't really fucking with them. And you know, there was a little baby sitting on this woman's lap, to my right in the meeting, and the little baby stuck his tiny hand out and it grabbed my pinky, and like I hadn't touched a child, you know, in forever, you know. And you know, I remember on the trip back, my mother picked me up and we stopped at this coffee joint, you know, and I was waiting in line to get a donut and some coffee or whatever, and I see all these people like in front of me, and they're going up, I'll take a jelly fill, I'll take a glaze, I'll take a powder, whatever, you know, and I'm overwhelmed. Because I was used to simply getting what they were given, like putting my tray up and getting what they were given, you know, and I was overwhelmed with, wow, look at all these choices. And it was metaphorical of what recovery was going to offer me, you know, but I was overwhelmed with like this feeling of gratitude for the difference of where my bottom had taken me and the possibilities for my future. And so, you know, as it came around to me in this meeting, and I was offered the opportunity to share. You know, I reached out for help, and I just said, hey, look, I just came out, and you know, and I actually shed a tear. And I'll tell you, I'm the type of person that because of that bullshit ideology I bought into as a child, you know, I can count the times I've cried. You know, I know when they are. You know, and they're few and far between, and that was one of them, and that was big. And you people, the community, really reached out to me, okay? And I'd like to say that you know, when I came into those rooms, I didn't know who I was. I didn't know who I was going to be clean. You know, I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't know anything. And, like, you know, we have a lot of people that are willing to come up to us and give us phone numbers and hugs and all of that stuff. But see, that's not enough. I learned for myself that it wasn't enough for me. That I had to actually hug back metaphorically. I had to involve myself with you people. You know, become a part of the community. Involve myself, develop relationships with you people, and actually use those phone numbers. Because there's a big difference between getting them and using them. And initially, I got a sponsor that first day, and initially, you know, for my 90 and 90, how we did it, we didn't really go through the steps until after that. My responsibility was to develop relationships with people in and out of the rooms, from the rooms, outside of the rooms, as well as in the meetings, and do the things that they were doing to actually become a part of this community. Because the truth is, if I'm going to divorce myself from all those people, places, and things, if I'm going to do that, I'm going to create a void within myself. And if I don't fill that void with this community, I knew from my past, from looking at my past, that I was going to revert back to what I knew best. You know, and I know that I have an innate need to be a part of, to be loved, you know, to belong somewhere. And you know, I needed to reach out and cross those lines, no matter how uncomfortable they were, to do the different things that y'all did, even if I felt crazy in my skin doing it. Like a lot of folks go to Denny's and drink coffee, you know? And like, I wasn't really feeling that, you know? But I did it anyway, you know? Another thing I like to say is, like, some folks wanted to go bowling, you know? And, like, you know, you've seen the shoes. That shit is crazy. But I went. You know, I went, and I looked like a fool and whatever. And you know, they also say one of the things, don't leave before the miracle happens. And, like, for me, I equate that with, you know, being willing to cross those lines that were uncomfortable and throw myself into those situations, no matter how crazy I felt, until it took. Until I found my place. Until I found the things that I did like to do in recovery. And it takes time. It don't happen in a day. Well, it didn't happen in a day for me. To find the people that I was going to gel with. Because there's a lot of folks in the community, a lot of subsets within the community. It kind of took me some time to kind of find, you know, my close, you know, support group, if you will, you know, and I found for myself that, you know, I like to play poker. We play poker every week. It's nickel and dime stuff, you know, but it's a fantastic social gig. You know, I like to play ball. I play basketball, although Altoona's been ducking us, you know, I like to play ball. Every Sunday in State College, we have a grill at this park, and we play volleyball, you know. And I love to do that stuff. I love to go see movies. I love to travel. And you know, it took me some time to kind of figure out what I was going to like to do clean. You know, the prospect of set, you know, when you've lived your life a certain way for so long, and all you know is these people, these things, and this stuff, you know, it's the prospect of letting all that go was very, very scary for me, you know. And is there life outside of everything I had known? But another part of what was important for me to have to deal with is, you know, I did a lot of dirt in my life. And, you know, there's a phrase that says, fear of success. And I think there was like a part of me, like in my subconscious or in my heart of hearts, that kind of felt like, you know, I had done X, Y, Z in life. And so did I really deserve to succeed, whatever that was? And, you know, I like to talk about the steps and how the steps have been able to, reconcile me with my past and enable me to move out from here, if you will, because I couldn't change what I had done. But it was important for me to be able to forgive myself and do what I could in my journey to make up for those things and feel like I could move on. And so, you know, I talked about being alienated from society at large and us and them and all of that stuff. And, you know, I had a real real resentments with like authority figures and police and whatever. And, you know, I had to learn to, live in this society and let that kind of, let those bad packages of ideas, go, to smash them and move on to something different. And, you know, the first part of growing in that direction is just recognizing all these things for what they really were and that they were a bad package. And you know, the steps have afforded me, that sort of healing, you know, that sort of acknowledgement, understanding who I am and what made me up and what I can do to move out from there. And you know, I tell a story like, last year I was, you know, God has truly done for me what I couldn't do for myself, okay? In that, you know, He has, I couldn't touch everybody. I could not actually go back and make the neighbors love me or change the police, the local police department's, idea of who I am, you know, by like knocking on the door and saying, "Hey, look at the new shiny me." You know, but just by putting one foot in front of the other, you know, nothing real special, you know, in time, folks like, somehow their hearts and minds were softened that they have, acknowledged that I'm different today. And so much so, I was walking out of Walmart like a year ago, I'm walking out and this guy's coming in with his two daughters. And I recognize him. He recognizes me. He says, "Hey, Mark, how you doing?" And he's like, proceeds to introduce me to his kids. And, you know, so we do all that. And I walk out, to my car and I'm thinking, you know, he's one of us, you know, cause I can't keep track of all of us. You know, you see so many, you know, but it dawns on me that this guy was a cop that used to chase me when I was a kid. You know, and it was so big for me. It was big, you know, cause this guy that I was like my sworn enemy, you know what I'm saying? Like us and them, you know, had seen or had been moved by my journey in such a way that he felt comfortable enough to introduce me to his children. I mean, that's where we had come. And it was really healing for me. And today, like when I walk down the aisle of some supermarket and I see some old neighbor or whatever, you know, where once upon a time I might have ducked cause I'm not really trying to like, you know, figure out what sort of face or what sort of comment I got to come up with today. You know, what the steps have afforded me is a healing that I can be okay with who I am today, and I can walk down that aisle and I can meet whoever it is face to face, be okay with me, and interact with them like we're just regular people. And I see I'm off paper today. I'm not on parole or anything. You know, I see ex parole officers and whatever, and we talk just like we're regular people. And you know, that's big for me because I feel like I have been blessed with the rebuilding of bridges that I had thoroughly smashed in my journey, you know, heading towards my bottom. And and so having been through all that, I like to say that for me, maintaining my recovery is about recognizing if I'm feeling threatened or if I'm feeling resentful or if I do somebody dirty, you know, recognizing these things and stepping to my business. It's a 10th step. And you know, like if something's creeping up, I don't try to accumulate any baggage today. You know, I need to maintain my side of the street. And you know, the things that I work on today with respect to that aren't so much like I don't walk past stop and you know, I don't walk past the old spots and like start ticking and shit. That's not how I work today. You know, today it's different stuff that I'm dealing with. It's one thing I like to talk about is my partner, you know, for instance, is heading to law school. you know, and I was born in a time where the man was like the primary breadwinner, you know, and it's very threatening to me, to the prospect of having a female being the primary breadwinner. I mean, you'd think I'd be like, yeah, let's have it, you know, I can lay back and whatever, but for real, it's threatening to me, and you know, I had to bring that to my sponsor and talk about it, and I've learned that they're, instead of putting on that stony face and being like, yeah, don't bother me, you know, instead of doing that, what I do is there's some power in exposing it, bringing it out to the light, risking vulnerability, talking about it, and I can anticipate some compassion or understanding from my partner or the people that I deal with. I mean, it's just my experience that it's a leap of faith at first, but there's a reciprocal of compassion and understanding and a willingness to work with me with regard to that stuff that encourages me to continue to work in that direction. And that's the kind of stuff that I deal with today, you know. And I'm constantly, like for me, you know, it's important for me to meditate in maintaining my recovery. I try to have some quiet time where I kind of think over the things that are going on in my life and try to maintain this relationship with something bigger than all this. And I also like to say that something bigger than all this, like particularly early on, has been the community. You know, and I've learned that you know, where I see a group of us in front of me who have, you know, I'm not special, you know, have been through the things that I'm going through or will go through, you know, that there is experience, strength, and hope within that community that presents an idea of something that's bigger than me, because they've been down that road before. And so if I'm willing to risk vulnerability and throw something out in a meeting, then folks will typically share their experience and strength and hope with regard to that and provide me with something that I can move out with. You know, and that's how it's worked for me as well. But as far as the 12 step, like, you know, I have one sponsee right now who has really brought it all back to me. Like just going through the process again I discover through working with this individual, have discovered much more about myself, and it's really important. I recognize it's really important for me to never forget where I come from, you know, and I try to get inside of institutions, rehabs, and halfway houses for men in particular, and share my story, because no matter how far down that we've gone, that there's hope, that we can bring it back. You know, and also to, like, not only to spread that message of hope for those individuals, but to see those individuals, to interact with them, and remember where I come from, because you know, I can never forget, you know, where that journey took me, where my bottom was, and you know, it's like for me to continuously do service in that way, in that capacity, and work with the newcomer. You know, it helps me stay fresh. It helps me remember, and it encourages me to continue on. And today, you know, I'll tell you, my life with regard to you know, rebuilding relationships, that I had thoroughly abused, like my parents, you know, when I was a kid and I was getting picked up at the store for shoplifting or had to go to some meeting with the principals and the teachers and the counselors, you know, you know, when I had to have my parents represent me in court, you know, when I was getting in trouble as a juvenile or my name was in the paper, you know, it was always about me, you know. I never really had any compassion for what my parents must have gone through, you know, or ever thought about how, you know, at work, you know, how they must have felt when everybody around them was like, you know, you're their kid, whatever, you know. And, you know, I had to do a lot of work with that sort of stuff. I think that's the most powerful example for me of acknowledging, you know, that there was that I had done damage and that there was work that needed to be done. And today, man, I'll tell you, it's just amazing that when I come around my family, you know, there's not that look of anxiety, like what's going on now. You know, we just enjoy our time with one another. We love one another and interact, you know, as best we can as humans. But, you know, that's one of the most wonderful things that have happened to me in recovery is the rebuilding of relationships. For me, it's kind of the spiritual experience is the connection that I feel, the reconnecting that I feel with friends, family, and society at large. And my life is fantastic today. And you talked about changing attitude from negative to positive, and so much of what I've learned is about doing that, like changing my slant, you know, changing my perspective. You know, I can't change the world. I can definitely change the way I look at things, you know, and that's really worked wonders in my life. And I'm glad to have had the opportunity to come here, and that's all I got. Thank you.